Want to try a free sample?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, can something this small throw my body off balance? Time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your metabolism. Drink butter coffee instead to kill cravings.
Sensitivity.
One cheese.
Stop it. Stop it.
They don't know your body. Only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Signos.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
It is, and we are breaking down today where it all stands as we, as of recording of this, getting close to closing statements, and then it will be in the hands of the jury. Who knows what's going on by the time you watch this? Maybe Karen just flew to the moon randomly, just flew up and did it because it's possible, but not probable. We've learned that about vehicles flying into space with UFOs in this trial. Lots of things we've learned. Joining me to discuss, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor. I got a lot of things I want to kind of break through today. But first, I just want to throw it to you. Here we are. Both sides have gone. There is no, the prosecution's not coming back again. It's just going to be closing arguments now. Where do you think it stands? What's your thoughts on the case?
You know, this is a textbook handling of a retrial by the prosecution, foreseeing all of the conspiracy theories and trying their best to preempt those. Certainly, the defense scored some points here and there, but I think the overall picture of the case at this stage in the second trial is a lot different than the first, and I think it's weighing in favor of the prosecution.
Yeah, it's. I was very surprised by the defense this round. I think a lot of us thought, okay, well, they're going to bring in their greatest hits again, because that seems to be what I think a lot of people walked away going, oh, well, that's why there was a hung jury last time, because there did seem to be reasonable doubt in the last trial, not so much this one. But the last one was the whole conspiracy. He was beat up and da-da-da-da-da-da. They never really got into the whole he was beat up theory. They never brought in Proctor. They never really brought in any of that to the larger extent. They just kind of kept randomly throwing in the dog without context, which didn't make a lot of sense to me. Were they hoping the dog was going to land better with some of these experts? And then they could, you know, kind of, I don't say weasel, but weasel their way into adding in more of the third party culprit theory, or what the hell happened here? Is this all they wanted to do, is say Chloe, if he bit him, doesn't give very hard bites and he's dead? I don't quite get what the point even was about the dog.
That's been an ongoing issue in the second trial with the defense. It is kind of a failure to connect the dots. Mm-hmm. You know, you can inject doubt and you can raise issues that you know, might appear credible, that the prosecution might have trouble answering, but you've got to kind of all bring it home for the jury. You've got to have sort of a cogent alternative theory. In my appraisal, that's lacking here. There was a dog. Maybe there were some bites. Are they saying the dog killed him? What about you know, the other injuries to the back of John O'Keefe's head? That's not really explained well by some sort of dog incident. And then they left out this alleged altercation within the house with the Alberts, the other police officers who were buddies with John O'Keefe. And so certainly some confusion, but not the type that might result in a jury saying, oh, I could totally see an alternative plausible explanation here.
Why do you think they left out the whole thing? Why was Proctor not called? Why were so many of the officers not called? Because they were really going down that conspiracy route. And, you know, it worked okay for them the first trial, at least by adding in the possible factor of reasonable doubt or maybe something's going on here. I don't get it. What were they afraid of? Why did they not call them up?
You know, did defense see the writing on the wall that you know, perhaps these conspiracy theories with the officers were not the most credible, were not the most provable on behalf of the defense? You know, it's easy to say, hey, what about this guy planning this? And what about this guy being shady with his text, Trooper Proctor, that kind of thing. But to really sort of bring it home into, and therefore this is why John O'Keefe died and why Karen Reed didn't do it. They never got to that final step. You know, it's puzzling why they wouldn't show the jury about some of this underhanded and questionable practices on behalf of the police, including Trooper Proctor. They left that out, so the jury doesn't have this sort of ominous air about the conspiracy that they can tie things together with.
Yeah, I don't know why. This seemed to be the only thing that they could have done to make some sense and some reasonable doubt, and they chose not to do it. It seems Karen is running the show over here still. It's been very interesting to see her continue to come out of court every single day and say things. She's the one that's like leading them out. The attorneys are kind of second thought. They're in the background. They say whatever they're going to say if they need to. But for the most part, Karen just leads away, says whatever the hell she wants. Did the attorneys completely lose control of their client on this one, and she's just running the show? I mean, what is that like when you have a client that's like that, that just really, they're so bold, they're so big-headed that they're just going to do whatever despite what you recommend they do? At the end of the day, do you just have to let them run and do exactly this and let them burn themselves down if they're choosing to do so?
It's a terribly difficult balance because, you know, the client hired you. And so you have certain duties to the client, and the client gets to make some ultimate decisions in the case, including whether to testify, you know, some decisions on what the defense should look like. It can be really tough and frustrating for the attorney. You know, if you have a client who's terribly articulate and who's unassailable and who has, you know, a great reputation in the community, sometimes it makes sense to put them in the forefront. I'm not sure Karen Reed really has all those characteristics. So to allow her to be sort of leading out the band after court every day and talking to the press, I just can't fathom what benefits the defense is getting from that. And is it just Karen Reed sort of enjoying the attention and sort of the stroking of the ego? Perhaps, but now is not the time for that.
Yeah. Obviously, if she is found guilty, there's going to be a lot of civil suits, I would imagine, against Karen Reed for all of the chaos that was caused with Turtle Boy, with the harassment, there's a lot of things here. I get civilly how that could easily happen, but what about criminally? Is there criminal conduct that could have taken place here in terms of witness intimidation, harassment, all that sort of thing? And do you think if they do find her guilty that they would look back and go, okay, and what were you doing in this by accusing all of these people, making up this story when you know it was false? Can they go back at her with further criminal charges for all of the damage caused after the fact of John O'Keefe's death?
You know, usually under the law, the defense is given some significant latitude in deciding what the defense is going to be, how it's going to be presented. And even if jurors disagree with the truthfulness of that defense, that typically doesn't result in criminal charges. Here, there are some concerns. So Karen Reed was texting with Turtle Boy and sort of feeding him information, arguably knowing that he was going to go out and engage in what some have called harassing and intimidating measures with respect to these witnesses. So was Karen Reed an integral part of possible witness intimidation, possible witness tampering, possible witness harassment? That's a question that's up in the air, and the authorities within that jurisdiction are going to have to take a look at those messages. They're going to have to interview those witnesses and see if they felt intimidated, and ultimately decide, hey, do we want to continue sort of opening up this can of worms with this ongoing Karen Reed saga, or if she's convicted, do we just call it good?
That's a good question. Is it worth it for that community? I mean, they've already gone through enough. I'm sure everybody's just, whatever side they're on, they're ready for it to be done. They're ready to take a deep breath and try to get back to some semblance of normal life with all this vitriol left and right everywhere. I don't know. I wonder what would happen. Let's say she's not found guilty. Let's say, there's options here. I think the manslaughter one is pretty solid. What about second degree options here? There's those two charges. Do you think she meets the criteria for second degree murder?
You know, in reviewing the law in this jurisdiction, second degree murder is a pretty high bar. It appears to require intentionality. It appears to require deliberate conduct to bring about the death of another person. You know, the evidence has been mixed. There has been some evidence that Karen Reed had hostility towards John O'Keefe, that they were fighting very shortly before this incident took place. And in fact, Karen Reed's voicemails and texts after the incident took place certainly show an animus on behalf of Karen Reed towards John O'Keefe. Is that enough to get him there for a jury to conclude, hey, she did this on purpose, she did this deliberately? That question is still open, but I agree with you that the vehicular manslaughter, her essentially being drunk and causing the death of John O'Keefe, that one seems pretty darn solid, and that's a pretty darn serious charge as well.
It really is. Let's say she gets found innocent on all charges. It's free. What happens then? Do you think that there's still going to be civil cases against her? I mean, that obviously getting convicted would be very helpful in those civil cases for the defendants there. But does that continue to go forward kind of, you know, a la OJ?
You know, it very well could. I think one of the first things that's going to happen if she's acquitted, more documentaries, more Karen Reed.
Yeah.
We're going to see her continuing sort of her media campaign. She appears to really enjoy that. You know, could there be civil wrongful death claims against Karen Reed? Absolutely. And in fact, the civil burden of proof to win on a wrongful death claim against her is much lower than in the criminal context. The criminal context is beyond a reasonable doubt. Civil context is just more likely than not. Mm-hmm. So 50% or above, can a civil plaintiff meet that against Karen Reed? Be a heck of a lot easier than in the criminal trial.
Yeah, it certainly would. There is already a documentary crew following her around yesterday. I don't know if you saw it. She's back. Wonder what that one's going to be. Is it going to be a follow-up? Is it a part two to the investigation discovery one that went so well? That to me is just kind of baffling. Does she think she's going to do it better this time? Did she think she did a good job last time, considering that seems to be what's really sinking her own words? Hey, let's bring the camera crew back in. I mean, what the hell?
Right. I mean, you know, in my appraisal, she seems to kind of have a detachment with reality.
Yeah.
And with what's going on with how people are reacting to her. You know, she went to John O'Keefe's mother shortly after this incident and asked for all of her stuff back. It didn't seem like a very warm or empathetic encounter. And then she mocks John O'Keefe's mother later in one of these documentaries. So is she the type of person who just doesn't really realize, hey, this is a bad look. You're rubbing people the wrong way and you're hurting your legal position. I don't think she realizes that. And I think if she is acquitted, she would be gung-ho on more of that media campaign.
I know that, you know, and I'm sure they probably haven't, but obviously her attorneys are human too. You're a human being. You're an attorney. I believe you're human. Kind of, yeah.
Mostly human.
Mostly. Do you think... I mean, what the hell do you think has been going through their heads at the end of the day and all this? When they're working their ass off, they're trying anything they can, and they're doing the best they can with what the cards that they've been dealt. But at the end of the day, when they get there, they try to give their arguments that they're going to give, and then they turn around, and the next thing is Karen's own words in another clip that Brennan is playing that just contradicts everything that they just tried to establish with the jury. That's got to be such a headache to have a client like that. And to try and be, especially when you have that much spotlight on you, and it seems like you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, if you're her defense attorneys.
Tony, totally. And you know, being on the criminal defense side of a death case, the deck is already stacked against you. They've already got a ton of evidence. The government has a ton of resources. They're conducting ongoing investigation. You're trying your best to, you know, get your shots in. And then, you know, you get punched in the face by your own client, metaphorically. That is such a setback, and it can be demoralizing. And, you know, the fervor with which defense has tried the second case was a little bit more muted than the fervor they had in the first case. And could that be a function of them sort of realizing, gosh, my client keeps making us take two steps back after we take one step forward? You know, I'll be interested to see what their demeanor and presentation is like in closing arguments, if it's as fiery as in the first case, or if it's a little more subdued and a little bit more conscious of kind of the tone of how things are going.
It makes me wonder if they're saving face a little bit out there, especially when they're leaving court every day. So there's not in you know, in the ether forever, clips of Alan Jackson fervently defending Karen Reed on the steps of the courthouse. There really isn't any of that in this trial. It's Karen Reed defending herself. So I'm wondering how much of that is just kind of a, let's think this through. PR-wise, a year from now, 2 years down the road, do we want those clips out there if somebody's Googling me? You probably don't. That probably is not. I mean, if somebody's going to hear Karen Reed, they may not connect the dots right away that you were the attorney. So maybe just back away as far as you can without being too obvious about it. I'm wondering if Alan Jackson has done that a lot, especially since we've seen, you know, Alessi being seemingly almost the lead on this, being out there and being the face of the defense more than Alan Jackson was this time. Is that a move on Jackson's part? I'm going to stand in the corner. You go get him, champ.
You know, the PR effect of this case, especially for the defense attorneys, cannot be understated. I don't know how much they're being paid, but I doubt that Karen Reed has, you know, $10, $20 million that she is paying them. I think It's probably something much more modest. So their possible benefit in this case is sort of the PR momentum and getting benefits from the public awareness and them being on a high-profile case. But if that ship's going down, you know, you don't necessarily want to be at the forefront. You don't necessarily want to be the captain. You might say in so many words or through so many indirect measures that, hey, actually, this person's steering the ship. Because if it goes down, that possible benefit from doing these two very long trials for which they're likely not being fully compensated is diminished. And so you kind of have to cut your losses and do some damage control. Maybe that's what's happening now.
I know there's attorney-client privilege, but once this is all done, I know there, if she's guilty, there's going to be appeals, and it's going to be up to them if they're going to be sticking around for it. Let's say they're done. Let's say they cut ties with Karen. She has to get new attorneys for whatever happens next. Can they ever go and talk about this, or is this, does a current attorney-client privilege last for like ever, like an OSHA type thing where the doctors, even if you're not their doctor anymore, you can't go talk about your patient's well-being? Can they ever at some point get on the dock and just let it loose about what it was like behind the scenes representing Karen Reed?
You know, attorney-client privilege is sacrosanct, and that really remains in place indefinitely. But it usually applies mostly to communications you've received from your client through specific measures and decisions taken within the case. So you can't talk about that, but could you talk generally about your impressions of the case, your impressions of being a defense attorney on the case? Certainly some defense attorneys have done that after cases like this. Additionally, if there was ever a conflict or a dispute between Karen Reed and her attorneys, there is a way to forfeit attorney-client privilege if such disputes arise. And so we'll have to see if things go south and shit hits the fan. Do these parties start to, you know, Karen Reed and her own attorneys, Does there arise a conflict between them? Does that let us learn more as time goes on about what was going on behind closed doors in this case? It very well could.
It's one of those train wrecks. You kind of just want to keep watching even when it's done. Like, how is the disaster cleanup going here today? What is it looking like? I'd buy the book. I'd be very curious to hear what it was like trying to represent Karen Reed behind the scenes. What was going on? What happened every day? And how much of a curse this must have been to be her defense attorney on especially trial number two. Let's talk about some of the evidence, specifically the big pieces that are very much at the forefront of this. Taillight pieces, that's the big thing. Broken taillight pieces found near O'Keefe's body, found all around O'Keefe's body. We saw in the accident reconstruction where the taillight explodes as it hits an arm, even lighter weight than O'Keefe. It goes everywhere. In fact, the pattern very much represented what reality took place when that taillight exploded, the scatter of the debris. The defense is claiming that they were planted, but would that require, what would that require? I mean, in terms of coordination and planting, walk us through how difficult that would be to stage some sort of planting of all these large and small and microscopic pieces of taillight in all these different places to frame Karen Reed.
You know, it would be a pretty involved process, and it would probably require multiple individuals coordinating with one another. You know, they would have to get the pieces, the shards, whatever you want to call them, from the taillight, from the specific taillight of Karen Reed's vehicle. You know, did they get that allegedly, according to the defense, at the police station and then take those pieces in, what, a plastic baggie or something and take them to the scene and make sure that no one sees them and make sure that there are no ring videos from neighbors that catch their movements and then plant them exactly where John O'Keefe's body was, but make sure the Alberts inside the home don't see them, make sure they're not detected, make sure that they're... most police vehicles have GPS, and so they'd have to take a different vehicle. If they took a different vehicle, oftentimes the license plate on those vehicles would be recorded by certain devices throughout the city at intersections, stuff like that. And so it would take a whole lot to accomplish this successfully without anyone knowing about it. And that's really what the jury would have to believe if they're to conclude that this evidence was planted, and that's a big ask.
Well, and what I don't get about it is there was taillight pieces that they saw there while they were trying to revive O'Keefe. I mean, that was there. There was, but their argument seems to be there was more taillight planted, even beyond what was there. What's, why, like, if it's already there, why would you go plant more? And number two, just the logistics of this happening is asinine. Because if you live in a place with snow or ever have, and you're out there in a blizzard and people are packing it down as they walk and then they leave, that whole layer of snow basically turns to ice. It's just going to be one thick, hard layer. And these taillight pieces that they found days later, because everybody's like, well, how did they find them later? Because they were underneath all of that. You can't get that up unless you're going to go out there with a flamethrower and melt the snow in the yard. So it's already below this ice layer. Once it melts, then, oh, here's some more that we found. It makes logical sense that that's what took place, not they came back later and put a few more down just for good measure. it doesn't make sense. I mean, like, if there was no taillight and then there's taillight, okay, but there was already taillight.
Yeah, and on top of that, witnesses, Jen McCabe and another female witness report that when they met up with Karen Reed early the next morning, the taillight was already broken. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that, like, the police broke at the police Sally department port, yeah, and then put extra shards or something. All of the witness testimony and the evidence procurement measures that you just mentioned seem to more closely align with she hit him and there were some shards and it took a little bit to get all of them because of the elements weather-wise in the case, as opposed to, you know, somebody going and planting a few more shards to make it, you know, to tip the scales even more, I guess. But it seems like that measure wouldn't be totally necessary to do that. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of just the defense being subjected to scrutiny and it kind of falling apart.
Yeah, it's like, let's throw this out there. We don't not really going to explain it, but we're just going to throw it again. Reasonable doubt. That's what they're trying to create. But you can do it. You don't have to explain anything with reasonable doubt. You can just be like, here, add this to the equation. Add some sprinkles. You don't like that on the cupcake? Too bad. It's there. Maybe they'll pick off the sprinkles. DNA is usually a pretty big thing in a murder case. Here, I'm wondering how strong a role it's playing. I mean, they did find DNA on Karen Reed's rear bumper in the form of a hair of John O'Keefe, or they found it out where the tail light was cracked. That doesn't seem to be, I don't know, nobody's making a huge deal about that one, it seems. Certainly the prosecution has brought it up, but it doesn't seem to be a big key thing. How much do you think the DNA is weighing on the jury's mind in this case, connecting John O'Keefe directly to the accident with Karen's car?
You know, there's something called the CSI effect based on that show CSI where, normal people, jurors have watched CSI, Law and Order, they get wind of these forensic analyses that are conducted, including DNA and how important they can be and what they can show. And so here, you know, in terms of a vehicle strike, you've got the guy's DNA on the back of the vehicle where prosecution is saying it struck him. I think that's pretty darn strong. Defense might argue in closing, hey, they were dating at the time and he had other contact with the car. But, you know, with that part of the car on the back of the bumper where he supposedly hit, I think it's significant. And I'm wondering if the prosecution is just going to play that hand more strongly in closing argument.
I do wonder about that. O'Keefe had 36 abrasions on his arm, no broken bones. Prosecution says it's consistent with being struck and dragged along broken taillight pieces. Lack of fractures there. That's a big thing that the defense is saying. Well, but he didn't break his arm. I thought it was laid out pretty well. I mean, it was kind of a weird factor in all of this. Like, how did he not break his arm? But I'm not an accident reconstructionist. I'm not someone who works in, I don't know how these things work. And sometimes you're surprised by information that you really have no knowledge about. I felt that the prosecution did a pretty good job explaining here scientifically, here's how this happened. Here's other cases where, yes, it looks pretty horrific, but amazingly no broken bones. So clearly this sort of thing can happen. Of course, the defense has come in with their experts wearing a pink tie and saying the exact opposite, and saying happy birthday to their son while a mother is in the gallery for the murder trial of her own son. Again, you can't make this shit up. How do you think that's playing to a jury? Because it's battle of the experts, really. The jury is getting two people outside of the case saying, here's what you need to believe because the science says this. And then they have another one over here saying, here's what you need to believe because our science says this. Where do you think the jury's sitting in this case specifically and all of that?
You know, I think the jury is going to draw upon their common sense and experience. You know, we've all seen folks who have taken bad falls or been in a serious fight or been hit by a car. You know, I do some personal injury work. Mm-hmm. And we have pedestrians who are hit by cars hard. It doesn't mean that there's going to be a fracture. There will likely be some injuries, some significant injuries, but it doesn't require a fracture in order to prove that this was a vehicle strike. And so, you know, John O'Keefe was a formidable dude. He was 200 pounds plus. He was a police officer. You know, a car hitting him could cause damage, but it doesn't mean that it requires a broken bone in order to prove this is a vehicle strike. It doesn't.
Yeah, that seems to be something that, yeah, I mean, it makes sense in my mind that it doesn't have to be because no two accidents are ever going to be exactly the same. I feel like they're trying to push it into a box and go, look, all accidents will have broken bones. O'Keefe didn't have broken bones, must be innocent. And that's part of it. They don't ever provide any alternative theory because at the end of the day, you still got a broken taillight. At the end of the day, you have it shattered everywhere. At the end of the day, you have a dead man with signs that look like he was struck by the vehicle with pieces of the taillight embedded in his clothing. And there's no other reason as to how this happened other than the Alberts have a dog and that didn't do anything beyond beyond light abrasions that didn't even puncture skin. What are you left to believe here if you're the jury? That he's just somehow randomly died in the front yard and the dog gummed him?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, on the defense side, reasonable doubt is great, and you want to suggest what you can ethically suggest, but what's better is having a plausible alternative explanation. That's something we don't really have here. You know, how did the shards of taillight get into the clothing of John O'Keefe? Are they saying that someone went with some sort of surgical device and planted them in there? It's just very implausible. And then how did he die? You know, how did the dog cause him to get the injury on the back of his head? You know, if there was some altercation inside the home, they certainly haven't explained how or really why. So what's the jury left with? Hey, if this wasn't a vehicle strike, what was it? If the defense doesn't have an answer to that, defense is in trouble.
It's insane. Karen Reed, of course, her own words, and this is going to be interesting in closing arguments. I'm sure we're going to see a firework show of all of Karen Reed's greatest hits and probably some new ones. She, of course, admits dropping off O'Keefe at the location where he died. Last person known to see him. And as we know, in various clips, it goes from I don't remember dropping him off there to I left him at the waterfall to, oh, I did drop him off there. And then he got out of the car and he was heading towards the house to I dropped him off. I saw him go in the house. Then I dropped him off and he's in the general vicinity of where I last left him. I mean, it's all over the place. It's everywhere. It's everywhere you want to be, just like Visa. And what's a jury left to think when the defendant is saying 50 different things about where she last left the dead guy?
That's a defense attorney's nightmare because, you know, in a case I just recently handled, it was a homicide case and the suspect who did not do it was steadfast from the beginning in all of his statements, completely consistent, forthcoming, you know, not a hint of shadiness whatsoever. Here we have Karen Reed saying everything under the sun, all of which conflicts with each other. It looks like a person who's lying, who's grasping at straws, who's trying to use deception to get out of this very serious incident. And there's no good way to explain, you know, that she saw him go in the house, but then later she says, I could have hit him. And you know, it just doesn't add up. And the jury, they're not stupid. They're going to see that. They've dealt with humans before who have been inconsistent and have drawn inferences about whether they're telling the truth. They're going to draw the same inferences here.
Likeability is certainly important, and as much as it should be about the facts, likeability is going to be a key factor no matter what. Trial number one, you didn't have a lot of Karen being all that vocal. We didn't have all these clips from all the interviews that were being played, and now we got a chance to see Karen, and I don't think Karen Reed reads very well to a jury. She just doesn't have it. And I don't expect her to be able to turn it on or change. It's why she's not testifying. But we got to see all of that. And then we got to see her defense attorneys, too, this round. And they didn't come across the most likable either, at least in my opinion. I mean, if you're an FKR folks, you know, you're going to cheer on anything. I mean, they could have come out there swinging axes, wearing cats as hats. And they'd be like, oh, these people are great. I'm going to go to the pet store tonight and get a cat hat. It's just, you know, the blind leading the blind sometimes. But the fact that they weren't very likable to the jury, at least in my opinion, how do you think that's going to affect this case? And again, that's my opinion. I felt they didn't come across very likable to the jury. They felt very confrontational. I think they were insulting their intelligence a bit. The way that they would lead them on for like hours down these dark roads that just had stupid answers to stupid questions that really didn't pertain to the case. How do you think it... how do you think they ran to the jury? You heard what I thought.
It's one of the biggest changes in this case from the first trial to the second trial is the likability balance. In the first trial, prosecution wasn't very likable. I thought their opening statement was garbage. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It was. The guy just droned on and said, this witness will do this. This witness will do this. On top of that, you had Trooper Proctor and some shadiness going on there where he is being disparaging about Karen Reed. Likability of the prosecution was very low in the first trial. Here, this has totally shifted. The likability of Karen Reed and her statements that appear aloof, that appear sort of detached from reality, callous at times. And then on top of that, her defense attorneys, I think, went too hard on some of these folks, especially when they didn't have the goods to back it up. And it's sort of this bluster in court that leads to nothing and just needlessly extends the trial. Jurors are human beings. That likability factor is going to be very important. We're talking about a death case, and it is not in favor of Karen Reed at this time.
That's all so very true. The fact that nothing is likable here, it really shows just how different a case can be when tried again. And exact same evidence, really, for the most part. Little new things popped up here and there because they discovered different ways of extracting data, and Karen Reed opened her mouth. But other than that, it's the same damn case, and we're really feeling completely different about it. That just shows how important it is for, I think, everybody to be on the same page. How would you read how different this is, and is this what the defense intended? At the end of the day, do you think Karen Reed's attorneys are sitting there at the Capitol Grill drinking the defense fund? And are they feeling good about themselves? Do you think that they're feeling this landed really well? I'm curious.
Oh, you know, I think they would be going through in their head, you know, how did I feel at this stage in the first trial? And I bet they felt pretty darn good, probably pretty righteous, pretty confident about things. And then contrast that with, hey, how am I feeling today at this stage in round two? I think they've got to be feeling disheartened, scared. It's a scary process. And just based on how different the tone of the second trial has been. You know, we underestimate tone sometimes, but we're talking about human beings in these jurors, and tone can matter a great deal. Momentum, these intangibles, and whereas the Reed camp had those intangibles on their side in the first trial, they certainly don't now, and I bet they're shaking in their boots.
I would imagine so. I don't know that Karen is, though. I think Karen's in Karen land. Have you seen her come out of court the last handful of days? What's been your read on that?
Oh, man. Kind of a misplaced confidence. Mm-hmm. Hints of audacity that are probably... it's probably not the right time to be overly audacious, especially with how the trial's going and what you're charged with. You know, it really seems like she just doesn't have a great handle on how people are reacting to her. And it's fun to kind of, you know, be the peacock and get all this attention and talk about your case. But if you're doing damage over and over to that and your reputation, and you're not even seeing it, it's puzzling.
It's that ego bath that she talks about. I love the ego bath as she walks out of court. That was her exact term, ego bath. I don't think she realizes that she's bathing in bleach. Like, it's not going to work. You're going to get shiny clean for a moment, and then it's going to eat away your flesh. Like, it's just, it's not the type of bath you want to be in, Karen. You better get out of there. There was no rebuttal by the prosecution. I was a little bit surprised by that, but, you know, sometimes less is more. What was your reaction?
I was surprised, too. Judge Cannone made a statement around the time defense was going to wrap things up, saying, like, hey, these jurors are tired, we're fatigued, something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that sort of telegraphed to the prosecution, like, hey, you can put on another four experts and we could drag this thing out another 2 weeks, but is that going to help you with this jury? Have you already made a strong enough case such that the risk of fatiguing these jurors further and possibly getting them not on your side, is that worth it? And I don't think it was worth it. So I think the prosecution made a calculated calculated decision that, hey, we're not going to pile on anymore. We've done what we needed to do. Let's give it to the jury.
And that's been an interesting thing, hearing people describe what the jury is looking like, and even the judge saying it as well. And she said something to the effect of, yeah, they're looking fatigued, or I don't remember exactly what she said, but something of that nature. What does that tell you? As an attorney, as a defense attorney, as a former prosecutor, when we're getting close to, I mean, we are now have the defense being wrapped up and they're showing that sort of fatigue as you're still trying to present your case in chief in the last handful of days. And they're looking like, God, get me the hell out of here. To me, that doesn't seem like it's leaning towards we believe the defense very much. But you tell me, can that be read both ways? How do you read it?
I think it can definitely be read both ways. The prosecution took a lot of time in presenting their case here. So the defense took a substantial amount of time too. But it can be overall fatigue. And when the jurors duty is to decide, has the prosecution won? Have they met their burden? You know, if they're fatigued and like rubbed the wrong way and not feeling great, sometimes that bleeds into their analysis of, hey, did the prosecution meet this or not? Well, I feel, you know, really horrible about just my role here and how this has gone for me. And so maybe I'm not overly jazzed with the prosecution. Maybe I'm not so inclined to determine that they met their burden. I think the fatigue may weigh in favor of the defense, even though it sort of came out more saliently during the defense's case in chief.
Yeah. I mean, imagine jurors have to have there's got to be some sort of a timeline on this for a lot of cases where, like, how many days in, how many weeks in until they're just like, I'm ready to be done? Or does the case have to be more compelling to keep them in there and not be, because again, I feel like if you're looking at what the defense is bringing, it was a lot of monotony that didn't really go anywhere. That would, I think, after a few runs of that and you keep seeing the same thing that they're running, you go, okay, I'm not paying attention. You know, you're human. You wanna, but you're not gonna give it that full attention that you otherwise would be. It's fascinating to hear about that.
Exactly.
The decision, and the last thing here, I think we'll talk about Karen Reed choosing not to testify. Probably a good idea. A little bit surprising, because it's Karen Reed. I kind of thought maybe she's going to want to take that stand. She was kind of elusive and evasive about it when being questioned about it in front of the courthouse the last handful of days, until towards the end when the attorney spoke up, like, no, she's not testifying. Do you think that's the right choice here on this? It is Karen Reed. I don't know that she knows how to turn on the niceness, but I don't know. I don't know if there's anything that she could have added to this that would have been positive. What's your thoughts?
That's the thing, is the risk-reward calculus for Karen Reed testifying so strongly weighs in favor of risk. She could get crucified up there, in part because she's given all of these prior statements, many of which are inconsistent. And the prosecution would play them again. It'd give them another chance to get those inconsistent statements in front of the jury. And then you have this seasoned litigator, Hank Brennan, the prosecutor, peppering Karen Reed with questions, trying to have her explain the unexplainable. And so absolutely the right move for her not to testify. She could have all but sealed her fate if it hasn't been sealed already.
I don't think she could get up there. And I was kind of weighing this because we have the Diddy trial going on as well too. And people are wondering if he's going to testify, which I think is an insane move as well. But at the same point, that may be your only option because she has not been humanized very well in this. She appears to be a very narcissistic monster. At least that's how she's coming across. Yeah, I don't know how, is there anything that they can do here in closing arguments before this gets to a jury that is going to humanize Karen Reed? If you were there, you're representing her, how would you close this thing out if you are the defense attorney for Karen Reed?
You know, on that issue of humanizing Karen Reed, I think it's so important because we're talking about someone who allegedly ran over their loved one with a vehicle and killed them. And so as defense, perhaps they argue something like, hey, Karen Reed's life was a little messy at the time. Sometimes our lives get messy. We've all experienced that. And you know, that doesn't mean that we went out and deliberately killed somebody. It was a chaotic situation. She was distraught at times. She did have to get mental health treatment because of this. This was a very difficult, traumatic sequence of events for her. So don't hold that against her. See her as the human being who she is. But the human being who she is doesn't mean that she, you know, ran over her loved one with a vehicle and killed him. I think they have to go some iteration of that.
Is it almost just like backing down to, okay, she hit him, but it wasn't on purpose. It was total accident. Like going, like just leaning into the manslaughter charge. Obviously she's going to get something for that if she's found guilty there, but is it just more like mitigate the second degree charges out over here? Let's do this, make her human. And it's just this manslaughter and it's horrible, but she's human and she reacted inappropriately. I can't imagine they're going to do that, but maybe the best bet, honestly, to give her some sort of human quality, especially when it comes to sentencing.
It's not an uncommon approach by defense, especially if defense thinks they're losing the trial, to try and avoid that more serious charge by asking the jury to kind of compromise, to kind of say, hey, look, you know, there just isn't enough evidence of second degree murder that she intended to mow this guy down. You know, if you got to find her guilty of something, find her guilty of this much lesser offense that requires a lot more lenient sentence. That would not be uncommon. Here, it would possibly blow up the defense's credibility because they're kind of saying from the outset, they've been obstinate. No, none of this is true. There's all this other stuff going on. But then to come back to the jury and say, hey, well, okay, something's true, is not a good look.
Yeah, I mean, and another thing I noticed from the opening statements that Alan Jackson gave, that there was going to be some witness, at least he mentioned it there, that is going to show and prove that someone else saw John O'Keefe go into the house. We never saw that. That witness never materialized. Was that just made up? I mean, I can pretty much say, you know, anything you want in those opening statements, and maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't, but it does get into the juror's mind a bit. Okay, where is that? And even if they don't remember seeing or hearing the testimony, they may go, well, he told us, I just don't remember. That's an interesting piece of this. Did they have somebody at some point in time? Did they think they were going to have somebody? Did they just hope maybe another weird man is going to show up in a gravelly voice and say, look at the people in the house. I saw them. I was hiding in the tree. Or like, I don't know. Like, what what the hell was that?
You know, that's an astute observation, Tony, and I bet it's an observation prosecutor Hank Brennan has made, because the bar for saying stuff in opening statement is pretty low. You got to have a good faith basis that you think it's going to come into evidence. That means you have to have at least identified in your own mind who the witness is. It's quite strange that defense didn't answer to that representation they made in opening statement. I wouldn't be surprised if Hank Brennan gets up there in closing and says, hey, remember everything there the defense is trying to sell you in this case? They said you're going to see or hear from a second person who said John O'Keefe went inside the house, and magically that person just hasn't appeared. Does that do damage to the credibility of everything else they're trying to sell you? You bet it does.
Yeah, I would imagine so, because that's kind of a big deal to make a statement like that. So many questions and so many pieces of this thing that the jury is going to get to deal with here in the coming days. Again, someone may be watching this by the time we already have a verdict, but I'm just going to ask you, because by the next time we talked, we may have a verdict. When this gets to the jury, again, we haven't heard closing arguments yet. What do you think? Is this going to be a quick one? Is this going to be a long one? What do you think we're going to get? What's your prediction?
I think there'll be a significant deliberation. I don't think it's going to be a one-day thing. I think it'll be multiple days just based on the amount of evidence through which the jury has to sift through. But on top of that, the jury's been here for a long time. They want to get out of there. And so it's not going to go on forever. And at least in my appraisal, I think the prosecution has pretty much locked up the vehicular manslaughter charge, which is serious. I think she'll be convicted of that. The real question is whether she'll be convicted of the more serious second degree murder charge. That one's more iffy, but certainly more likely in this round two than it was in round one.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, can something this small really throw my body off balance? Time to consult the online experts.
Hi, Felicia here with 1 million followers. That bite will destroy your metabolism. A drink butter coffee instead to kill cravings.
But is it really that bad? I had protein this morning, right? Ugh, but it looks so good.
Only eat after walking 10,000 steps.
Pie is only 2 steps from here. Am I overthinking again? Oh, the kids would really love this.
Fruit ruins insulin sensitivity.
Never eat after 7 p.m.
You gotta cut carbs for 30 days.
Always know every
Stop it.
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear, just your signal. Cygnos.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.